I'm Red Scott. Oh, it's just me. It's just me here. And I'm here to interview somebody who is not Ivan Hernandez, who's not going to be on this because he's too lazy and not interested in talking about canon or history. I have with me today, I don't know what to call you, fictional historian.
Actual historian. And fictional.
Well,
historian.
as it applies to this, Stephen Atwell, who's known for in the Game of Thrones universe anyway, his Race for the Iron Throne website, as well as his series of books that are on Kindle, including the most recent one, Race for the Iron Throne Volume 2, Political and Historical Analysis of a Clash of Kings, which is highly acclaimed by the people who have read it.
Thank you.
Welcome, Stephen.
Nice to be here.
And what is your actual day job, the thing you do to fund your passion?
My day job is I am an adjunct professor of public policy at CUNY in New York.
That's awesome. I assume, and knowing a little bit about academia, there's some sort of specialization that you're involved with?
I'm an expert in the history of U.S. public policy, sort of economic and social policy of the 20th century.
Man, that's a dead art. There's probably nothing relevant happening in that field.
Oh yeah. Funny story. I decided to write my dissertation on New Deal jobs programs in 2005. And I was like, this is basically a dead language. Everyone I'm writing about has been dead for decades. No one's going to be interested in this. And then all of a sudden the Great Recession happens. It's like, oh.
And it came up a little bit.
Yeah, everybody wants to know, how do we make jobs?
So the reason I've got you on here today for sort of a Patreon mini-episode for Boar's Gore and Sword is we happened to mention in passing during the Vikings podcast what era we thought, Ivan and I both thought, Game of Thrones took place in. And this is my view of history. I know that, like, Rome was pretty much ruling the world of somewhere between 0 to 600, and then the Enlightenment happened, like, 1,000 years later, and in between is just darkness for me. I have no idea what's going on. So I said 1100 AD is when I thought Game of Thrones was taking place. I forget what Ivan said. Do you remember?
Ivan was even earlier. He thought, like, 900 or something like that.
Right. So, and Vikings, you know, which we just discussed, takes place in the late 8th century.
Right.
So you immediately direct messaged me after hearing this episode. And we're like, nah, bro. So where would you say Game of Thrones takes place in a historical timeline?
So I would put it at, like, Westeros is basically in the late medieval period or the late Middle Ages, which is about the 14th or 15th centuries, right? 1300s to 1500.
Okay.
Whereas, like, the free cities of Essos are pretty much in the Renaissance.
So that's interesting. That's something, even when I was talking to you, so he's sort of fudging with timelines. We're not looking at one historical analog far as Game of Thrones
like to
is
say
concerned.
That George R. R. Martin, he likes to remix history. He's not, like, going one for one with anything. He's grabbing bits and pieces from all over the place and smushing them together to come up with something that he thinks is fun. But it's also the case that, you know, we think of, like, historical periods as very cut and dry, but they're much closer to sort of, cultural or economic or political, like, movements that ripple outwards. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Medici were, like, beginning to revolutionize Florence at the same time that the Hundred Years' War was still going on between England and France.
Gotcha.
So you have very much something that's definitively medieval at the same time that, you know, Donatello is getting commissions, you know, to produce, you know, bronzes that we think of as, like, absolutely, this is the Renaissance.
Right. So because, you know, these people don't have message boards or email, the spreading of ideas took a bit longer back then. So so you said you have somewhere between the medieval era and the Enlightenment. So what things in the Game of Thrones universe makes you say that I'm absolutely wrong and that 1100 is not when this takes place?
One really quick and easy way is you look at the level of technology.
Sure.
You look at Westeros, right? the show goes kind of all over the place, but you can see like the Kingsguard, for example, are wearing plate armor. And plate armor doesn't emerge in Europe until the late Middle Ages. Gotcha. So that's, you know, at the very earliest, you're talking 1300. More likely, you're talking 1400.
Right.
Just because you need a certain level of technology to figure out how do you make armor that is articulated, that is specifically made to measure to the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of very complicated parts that have to work in conjunction. So you need to have a certain understanding of how to shape metal in very specific ways. And it's also, the stuff is expensive. Like, you need you need a good supply of steel, you know, because if steel is super expensive, you're not going to go for giant, giant plates of it. You go for something much cheaper, like chainmail, for example, right? Which, you know, if you've seen Vikings, that's like the go-to armor that everyone's wearing, is they're wearing chainmail.
Interesting, because I think of chainmail, I think of as pretty intricate.
Well, it's difficult to manufacture. Not technically complicated, because you're just making rings and making rings and making rings and making rings.
It's just tedious.
Yeah, it's just hugely tedious. So the difference is that, you know, plate mail requires a high level of technical expertise in terms of, you know, you need to understand how you get metal to certain temperatures in order to produce steel as opposed to iron. You know, you need to combine various metals. There's a bunch of metallurgy involved.
Sure.
And then, you know, you need the skill of how do you actually construct it. You can get pretty much anybody to make chainmail. I mean, I remember making some at a museum when I was a kid. But it's just, who's got the time to bang, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of these rings together? So plate mail is a good example. Other things that you can see, crossbows and very advanced crossbows, like all the crazy ones that Joffrey likes to play with that come from Essos.
Uh-huh.
Those are fairly late.
So I was just about so something I'm curious about. So when you're describing this, are you talking about primarily the TV show canon or the book canon? And do you think those vary at all as far as timeline's concerned? Like, did the wardrobe department kind of paint you into a corner?
So the wardrobe department kind of goes all over the place.
Sure. I would imagine that would be much, much more variable than, you know, what's described in the book.
The books give a little bit of a hard and fast thing. So, on the other hand, there's some stuff where they're clearly borrowing. So, like, the stuff that Joffrey's playing with in the books, those are very specifically, like, mirrorish crossbows. We know how, like, you know, because Martin likes to talk about his arms and his armor and explain, you know, oh, this one works with a ratchet, and this one works with, you know, pulleys, and so on and so forth.
Right, which gives them a more definite minimum time frame.
Exactly.
Or when that would be popularized.
Yeah. But, you know, also, a lot of this comes from the, not just the books, but the kind of wider canon. Have you read the, like, history book, The World of Ice and Fire?
I actually own it, and I have not read it. It's sitting on my shelf.
Yeah, it's a little bit drier, because it's kind of a textbook.
Right.
But, like, we learned so much detail about the world and how it functions.
Mm-hmm.
Often in ways that really did change our sense of the timeline. So, for example, in Braavos, right, their navy uses the assembly line and interchangeable parts to make ships. Which,
sure.
And that's a historical thing. Venice used to do that.
Interesting.
Back
you're
in
saying
the,
Henry Ford didn't invent the assembly line?
No, he just invented
anti-Semitism.
Yeah,
oh, sorry.
That too. but also just figuring out that you could use it for more than just building ships.
Right.
They've got double entry bookkeeping. Mir has like lenses, telescopes, advanced crossbows. We think that they might have some sort of like antiseptic or antibiotic. There's something called mirish fire that you use in medicine, but it's not entirely clear.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, if you look at like more cultural stuff, right? The bits where Arya is hanging out with that theater company in Braavos. That's Elizabethan. That is like straight up George R. R. Martin wanted to do some like, you know, let me show you how I do Shakespeare.
So it sounds like the two worlds, we have, you know, sort of an earlier medieval time frame. You said like 1300s to 1500s. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And then we have the Enlightenment, which is more like, what, 1500s to 1700s?
Not quite. Enlightenment is... That's really 18th century, or, I mean, 17th century, 18th century. Uh-huh. Renaissance is like...
Sorry, Renaissance.
Yeah, so Renaissance is really, I mean, you know, you can go as like early as the 14th century and as late as the 17th century.
Okay. Okay, okay. So I mean, yeah, 17th century, so we're talking all the way up to the 1600s, which is blowing... my mind.
Yeah, well, that's
it's
the kind
my
of
mind.
That's the kind of weird thing about this whole thing about it, you know, time periods are more like movements, is that, you know, England and France were very much in the Middle Ages when Italy was like, hey, finance, humanism, you know, all of this stuff, and then it trickled outwards, and there were sort of, you know, people would come and be like, all right, let me explain this shit to you. Here's how we actually build buildings. And, you know, every so often someone would be like, oh, that's awesome, we'll take all of that. You know, but you also have things, and this is something that I write about sometimes. You know, we often have this idea that progress only goes in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, obviously, you know, whether it's culture or technology or whatever, there's a lot of examples of it going backwards.
Right, and just technology being lost.
Exactly. Or just sort of cultural trends that we think of as inevitable. Being violently reversed. So the one example that I write about sometimes is this thing that was called the refeudalization of Poland, or sometimes the second serfdom of Poland.
Gotcha.
Which, you know, you had Poland, which was, you know, especially in the Middle Ages, this really powerhouse state. Like, we think of Poland as historically, you know, a kingdom that just keeps getting beat up on by everybody. But they were, you know, really, really powerful. And then in the early modern period, you get this kind of right-wing revolution where basically all of these peasants who had gradually accumulated rights and property, all of these kind of ambitious merchant classes, get slapped down by the nobility. And in some cases, literally driven back to assist, you know, a state of semi-slavery.
Right.
And this has a huge negative impact on Poland's, you know, economic growth, you know, technological... Right, there's no money for, you know, there's no capital for new inventions if everyone's been forced back into basically producing, you know, surplus agricultural goods for export. Although there are some scholars that basically say that the you know, Industrial Revolution wouldn't have happened without cheap Polish grain 100 or 200 years earlier.
Interesting.
So, you know, there's always kind of trade-offs.
So we had for you specified like plate armor as a specific type of thing that sort of cements them where they are. So in Essos, what types of things sort of anchors that era for you? So you mentioned the plays that they have, the sort of Elizabethan style plays. Like, is there anything else specific that...
Economics. So, you know...
So you mentioned double-entry bookkeeping?
Yeah, double-entry bookkeeping, banking. I mean, the Iron Bank of Braavos being...
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about
a
that.
A very kind of extremely advanced, you know, merchant bank. But you also have things like trading cartels... You have a very diversified economy that, or economies rather, that, you know, focus on high value added commodities. So, for example, you know, Tiroš is specialized in dyeing, but it also has distillation. So, like a lot of, for example, Westeros doesn't seem to have like whiskey or any like brandy or things that require distillation.
Right.
Tiroš does. Lys produces a lot of chemicals, but also lace, you know, a lot of high-end textiles, for example, is a big one.
So it's about the specialization, not necessarily the specific technologies?
Well, the technologies can help because, you know, if you look at the way that economies developed in Western Europe especially, a lot of the sort of lead-up to the Industrial Revolution and the Industrial Revolution itself were in textiles. So, you know, the countries that became richest and got out ahead of the rest of the pack, you know, the Netherlands, and the sort of Low Countries in general, England, a lot of what they centered their economies on was the production of cheap textiles. And advanced textiles. So, you know, you England, for example, famously started just exporting wool, right? They had all of those sheep. And, you know, if you've got a lot of rain, right, you're going to get a lot of grass. So it's kind of a natural specialization. But then they move up the value-added chain. They stop just exporting raw wool, and then they export raw, you know, basic wool and cloth. And then they, you know, and they're exporting all of this to the Netherlands, which then turns it into very fancy cloth, and then they sell it back to England and everywhere else. Then England starts to, like, muscle into the market and say, okay, well, we want, you know, we want to do the specialized textiles ourselves. And that's why England and the Netherlands went to war so many times, and why, you know, for example, New York is New York and used to be New Amsterdam. So, you know, you can look at the sort of, okay, where are their economies based, and get a rough sense of kind of where they are in terms of technological development. On the other hand, there are some things that, like, stand out as kind of mishmash. So a lot of the free cities, Tiros, Lys, Mir, Volantis, etc., they're all slave societies.
Right.
Right, and not just any slave societies, but, like, 4/5 of the population are slaves. That is a rate way higher than the southern United States before the Civil War, really only seen in, like, the Sugar Islands of the Caribbean.
Interesting.
So that's...
So I'm just curious. Where did you pull an estimate of 80% of the people?
It's in World of Ice and Fire, but pops up in A Dance with Dragons when, like, Tyrion and other people go to Volantis.
Right, and so World of Ice and Fire, I believe that's a chronicle book that's explicitly in canon.
Yeah, so World of Ice and Fire takes the shape of an in-universe book that was written originally for Robert Baratheon, and then he died, and they cross out the name, and then it's written for Joffrey, and then they cross out the name, and then finally it gets delivered to Tommen. It's written by a guy, a Maester Yandel.
Gotcha.
And then there's another maester that he quotes a lot, and that's basically George R. R. Martin and his fan colleagues, Elio Garcia and Linda Antonsen.
Gotcha. And I was wrong. I just looked it up. It was actually published by Bantam. It's not a chronicle book.
Which makes more sense. Different meaning of chronicle.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. Not a chronicle. No. Okay. So that is... I had a question just before this. Well, I'm spacing on it. I remember now. So it's interesting too, just the way the storyline takes us. You know, we're sort of sold Essos originally through the Dothrakis,
right?
Which I think a lot of people would imagine. You know, they are presented as a less civilized society, and then you slowly realize that Essos. I hadn't thought about the fact that they do represent a lot of things that come along further in Earth history as we know it.
Yeah, although, you know, even with the Dothraki, this is one of the things that I wrote about in Race for the Iron Throne Volume 1, is that we see in the books, we see the Dothraki through the eyes of, you know, a 13-year-old girl experiencing profound culture shock.
Right.
But if you look at the details, you begin to see that the Dothraki are actually pretty sophisticated. One of the things that I always remember the most is there's a bit in her wedding where, you know, she goes to Khal Drogo's mansion, which he has outside of Pentos. Like, he owns property in the Free Cities. And all of the Dothraki are wearing silks. They're wearing clothing that they, you know, leave separately in these free cities. And then when they go back to the Dothraki Sea, they change.
It sounds like the TV show has kind of given them a short shrift.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the TV show has done some pretty heinous stuff with the Dothraki from, like, you know...
Well, especially in the most recent season. Like, they've been sort of reduced to almost a comedic affect.
Yeah, and, you know, even in the first seasons, there were a lot of complaints about, you know, them being ambiguously brown as opposed to a specific ethnicity. So, you know, one of the things that, another sort of detail that I always thought made the Dothraki fascinating is their role in the broader economy of Essos. They get tribute from a lot of places, right? And then they take it back to Vase Dothrak, which sits in the middle between the two big halves of Essos, right? The free cities in the west and the sort of vaguely Chinese empire of Yi Ti in the east. And these trading caravans come to both unite at Vase Dothrak. And that's sort of a major economic link. And the Dothraki, they don't engage in commerce themselves, but anyone who comes to Vase Dothrak has to give them tribute. So they're sort of raking in a fee from global trade, even though they're not engaged in it themselves. But then you look at their relation to the slave trade, right? The Dothraki go around and they take slaves in large numbers.
Right.
They then take them to Slaver's Bay. The, you know, the Astapor Yunkai Marine then basically refine the slaves. They train them. They give them particular skills. And then they sell them to Volantis and to the free cities in the west. So it's like this giant, you know, circular trade just on land.
Right.
Like the triangular trade of the Atlantic. So the, you know, the Dothraki are seen initially by Dany as kind of, you know, again, barbarians. But the more you see them, the more you realize there's a real kind of sophisticated culture going on here that has major economic implications for a whole continent. And then, you know, as Dany becomes more Dothraki, right, she learns the language, she bonds with Drogo, you see that kind of, as I've argued, cultural assimilation becomes power, because Viserys never does that. Right? He sticks with their barbarians, and that's why he gets a golden crown, and Dany ends up leading a Khalasar.
Yeah, I hadn't really considered that idea that, you know, obviously when you read the books, you're seeing it from her perspective. And in the TV show, it's sort of because, you know, especially like I've said this before, I saw the first season of Game of Thrones before I read the book, and I wouldn't have guessed that she was the point of view character.
Yeah.
Like so you just see that as being the, you know, the absolute as it was. You know, you're watching a TV show. We're watching it happen. We're not seeing somebody's perspective. And so that sort of, it makes it more immutable than it does when you're seeing it through.
Yeah. There's a certain assumption of objectivity, right?
Right, right. You know, that there's no false narrator.
Exactly.
You know, it's just a camera. It's just being filmed. This is what happened.
And Martin loves unreliable narrators. He uses them all the time. And, you know, one of the things that you lose in the adaptation is that internal monologue. And you can learn some really interesting things through the internal monologue. So one of my favorite little details is when Tyrion meets the mountain clansmen,
right,
like way back in Game of Thrones, he's observing their culture. And one of the things about the mountain men is they're democratic. They believe that everyone has a right to speak at council meetings, men and women alike. And Tyrion's response is, oh my God, that's backward.
And yeah, Tyrion is a straight nightmare person.
Oh yeah.
In the books, especially when he's in Essos, yeah.
Well, no, this is like Tyrion at the very beginning, right?
Oh, right, sorry, yeah.
He's just got out of his first trial by combat with Bronn and all that.
Right.
And what I liked about it was I was like, of course he'd think that. He's a nobleman. He's been raised his entire life to believe in status and hierarchy. And, you know, leadership by a single individual.
He's literally a sharper, more attractive Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah, kind of. If the rest of his society was, you know, doing nothing but validating him, which...
Yes.
Fair enough. And that...
They definitely don't have Twitter at this point, so there's he's not getting direct feedback.
And, you know, that's why... that's one of the details I thought really, really worked is... That's how a nobleman would think. That's
right.
That is the mindset of someone coming from a feudal society. And, you know, that's why as a fictional historian, I love to look at the moments in which that kind of thinking pops up and then also where it falls apart. And it's one of the things that I don't think the show has done quite as well. the Sparrows, for example, their that whole movement. In the show, it's pretty much, you know, religious fundamentalism as we understand it today.
Right.
Right? You know, the primary thing about the Sparrows that, you know, someone from the TV show who's only seen the TV show would think is they don't like gay people and they don't like women.
Sure.
Whereas in the books, the Sparrow movement is a populist, anti-monarchical, anti-noble, pro-peasant, like, left-wing social revolution. And they don't really care about sexuality, except to the extent that they can use it to defeat their political enemies.
Sure.
And that's a totally different portrait, but it's also... That's a sense of religion that makes absolute sense if you're thinking about the Middle Ages, if you're thinking about the Renaissance or the Reformation, but it's not something that we've experienced in the United States, you know, I mean, arguably ever, but, you know, certainly in many, many decades. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to associate, you know, religion with kind of right-wing fundamentalist religion because that's what's been in the news and what's been active in politics since the 70s.
Right. So obviously we could go on forever.
Oh, yeah.
But okay. So if you've enjoyed listening to Stephen, he literally has 4 books you can buy. So you can go look those up on Amazon. The most recent one, I don't have it in front of me right now, but what was the title of that again?
Race for the Iron Throne, Volume 2.
Race for the Iron Throne, Volume 2. He's also, I'm just going to guess, has Volume 1 out yep. there as well, and a couple other books, so you can go check those out. I'll put a link to those in the Patreon show notes. But so just to wrap up, so if you had, so there's sort of the Seven Kingdoms, you know, south of the Wall. If you had to, like, Price is Right it, getting rid of the $1 rules, like, what year would you say that Westeros is? If you just had to, as close as you could get, averaging out everything that's happening.
Hold on. Wars of the Roses. When did it start? This is the secret about historians, is, like, we pretend we know all the dates. We just, you know, Google everything. Okay, 1455.
There 1455 is fine, which is crazy. That's way later than I would have guessed.
Oh, yeah.
And similarly, you know, you have to give a single year to, let's say, the Free Cities of Essos, limited as opposed, because I know that's a larger landmass. You're crossing more societies. But where would you put those?
I mean, 1600, but with the slavery of, like,
right.
the so Caribbean we're in the 18th century.
All right. So, yeah, we're taking an element that just never was in that society. Okay. And... yeah, I'm trying to think. Would you even have a guess for, like, the Dothrakis as they're portrayed?
Well, it depends on
in
what
the
you
book,
think.
Sorry.
Yeah, it depends on what you think their, like, historical parallel is, because there's.
Yeah, I'm not, like, sure. Well, do you have a guess?
If they're the, so a lot of people basically say they are the Mongols, okay. Which would put them around 1200. I would argue, in fact, they are the closer to the Huns.
Okay.
And what, Attila the Hun was around 450s, 430s.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
So there's a huge variation there.
Right. I mean, listen, you're still getting closer than I got. But yeah, so thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm sure we'll have you back at a later time if you're interested in coming on.
Absolutely.
And where should people, like, what would you like people to see of yours online?
I would just go to raceforthenironthrone.wordpress.com. You can find all of my stuff there.
Right, which is wonderful. And he has some great textual episode recaps where they really get into the nitty-gritty of each of those episodes. So those are worth checking out. And those, I think you're just at Stephen Adewell on Twitter?
Yep. And Race for the Iron Throne on Tumblr as well.
Perfect. And I'm Red Scott on Twitter, and that has been this Patreon episode of Boars, Gore, Swords.